Hi, I'm Kim Masters. Thanks for listening to The Business. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today aren't just on the big screen. They can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate tales and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the globe. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I think my parents have always believed in me, and once it happened, they were like, okay, but I definitely think that there were times where they probably thought, oh yeah, she's just, you know, making home videos.
Filmmaker Lacey Schwartz always had the darkest skin in her nice Jewish family, and her documentary, Little White Lie, reveals the reason for that. Her parents allowed her to interview them about the family secret, perhaps not anticipating that her project would attract so much attention. She tells us about revealing her family's drama in her PBS documentary. But first on the news banter, what's going on at the Weinstein Company? Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kim.
So two of the smaller and yet much watched companies in Hollywood have had some interesting news this week, the Weinstein Company and Relativity. And you start with the Weinstein Company, Mike. They have just sold off their TV business. A lot of perception that this is a company that's having some trouble. And I will just say at the outset that the head of the Weinstein Company, Harvey Weinstein, has certainly been in some hot water.
He's got very different troubles on his hands.
Yeah.
But first, we could talk about this deal that's underway where British broadcaster ITV is spending as much as $950 million for Weinstein's TV operations, which is interesting because for the most part, there hasn't been much of a TV operation at the Weinstein Company other than Project Runway, which granted is a huge reality hit, although it's been on for quite a long time. Only more recently have we seen more projects come out of Weinstein's, including Marco Polo, which is a series on Netflix. There's a reality show on VH1 called Mob Wives that does quite well for them, but it's still a relatively small operation. We've seen a lot of international companies try to buy their way into the U.S. Through many means. ITV has an operation here in the United States, but this is an opportunity to perhaps get larger and also for the Weinsteins to finally expand their TV operations.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, like the Weinsteins need money. I mean, this is almost a version. Jeffrey Katzenberg is trying to sell the land on which his DreamWorks Animation exists for money.
Right.
And it feels like a version of that to me. And of course, when you start selling things off, you're sort of mortgaging your property, and it's not a good sign. Let's put it that way. Can we agree it's not an especially good sign?
Right. I mean, I think it's also, you know, there's still some money in that Weinstein name, and I think that's what ITV is looking for. And, you know, again, the Weinsteins, they haven't been a player in television, and I think the feeling is, why haven't they been? Is this the latest opportunity to maybe with some fresh capital to finally get into that role right when there are more buyers than ever and there are more opportunities than ever, be it Netflix, Amazon, Yahoo, what have you.
Right. Everybody wants in. Harvey Weinstein, of course, made a big name for himself with these art house films, which some of which became big hits, you know, and English Patient to The Imitation Game, or much more recently, they have Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight coming in the year ahead.
Yeah. And we're in an era of art house television now as well. So why aren't the Weinsteins more dominating in that world? Good question.
Now, Harvey has problems because this Italian model has alleged that he sexually assaulted her, groped her. Apparently, the police, it's reported, have listened in on a conversation in which he did not really seem to dispute that. So the other big, big question is, how much trouble is he in? And I'll use that to segue to Relativity, Ryan Kavanaugh's company. There was a lot of speculation in Hollywood that Ryan Kavanaugh, this company has not done especially well, has managed to raise money, and Ryan Kavanaugh certainly has lived very high, flying around in his helicopter and just, you know, very extravagant lifestyle. You know, their biggest film of the past year was a film called Earth to Echo. I don't think I've heard of this film.
Well, it didn't do much at the box office, right? Only about 40 million dollars.
So everybody sort of thought Ryan Kavanaugh was finally running out of rope. He found this company, Seven Peaks, I guess, or VII Peaks, something that nobody has ever heard of. They gave him $250 million. It doesn't go that far in the movie business. They said that they are typically involved with the distressed companies. Certainly, people were wondering if that's the case, if Ryan Kavanaugh can hold on. They say they're going to do an IPO and sell stock in that company. Usually, you have to have success to do an IPO. So Hollywood has really been, people have been scratching their heads. How's this thing going
to work? Well, perhaps that's enough money for Earth to Echo 2.
Yeah, right. Moving on, Viacom. Looking like it's having problems, which doesn't surprise people that much, I think, who are watching. This is the company that owns Paramount Pictures and lots of cable channels, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, MTV, taking a $785 million write-down, laying people off. Things have not been going that well at Viacom, and it looks like who knows what the future is going to be. Maybe they're going to try and sell.
Right. I mean, one of the problems is, you know, they rely a lot on cable at Viacom. They've got MTV, Comedy Central, Nickelodeon. And what we're seeing right now in cable is ratings across the board are down because viewers are getting their programming from other sources, including, again, streaming. And that's had an impact, particularly on Nickelodeon, where a lot of that programming migrated to online and a lot of people started watching it there. So ratings are down double digits at a lot of those networks. At the same time, reality TV is down. And there haven't been a lot of fresh hits out there lately. So it's a kind of a perfect storm. And Viacom's not going to be helped by the next big transition in late night over at Comedy Central as we wait and see what happens with the Jon Stewart spot as Trevor Noah takes over.
Yeah, Trevor Noah having his problems. And we've talked about the fact that Viacom is owned by Sumner Redstone, 91 years old, seemingly increasingly frail. He's been looking very frail for some time, didn't show up at the last shareholders meeting. It does appear to some people that perhaps Philippe Daumont, the head of the company, is going to trim it down and maybe try to sell. And we're in a kind of a turbulent environment right now.
An interesting world for mergers and acquisitions. And
absolutely.
I would not be surprised if in the next year we see some sort of interesting new combination.
Now, somebody is having some success out there. Universal has raked in more than $500 million. On Furious, Fast and Furious, the seventh Fast and Furious. One of the more unsophisticated questions I've seen kicked around on the internet this week is, are they greenlighting an eighth film? Let me tell you, Mike, the sun rises in the east and that film will happen unless the Earth actually goes off of its axis and the sun goes out.
Right. The only question is, what variation on the title will they use? Will they call it Fast 8?
I think
will they change the S to an 8 in the title? I guess we'll see.
I would say one thing that I'm curious about, you know, I think that this one did better than 6. I think people wanted to see Paul Walker's last performance, and I think there's a bump because of people wanting to see that. And I'm wondering whether that will hold over with 8. But they're talking at Universal about, you know, 9, 10, and 11. So they are by no means giving up on one of their precious franchises. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV Guide magazine.
I come from a long line of New York Jews. I grew up in a world with synagogue, Hebrew school, bar mitzvahs. So it never occurred to me that I was passing. I wasn't pretending to be something I wasn't. I actually grew up believing I was white.
Growing up, filmmaker Lacey Schwartz was told by her family that she had dark skin because she took after her Sicilian great-grandfather. The truth was not so simple. The man Schwartz had always known as Daddy was not her biological father. Her mother's black lover was. Schwartz documents the discovery of her racial identity and unveiling of a big family secret in her new film, Little White Lie, which recently aired on PBS. At first, Schwartz's mother, Peggy, was understandably reluctant to participate in her daughter's project.
Lacey came to me and said, "We have to talk." It was like, oh no, I'm scared. My reaction was, please make her be quiet, make her stop for a while.
And I told her I had to talk about it. I wanted to talk about why it looked the way I did.
Eventually, Schwartz did get her family on board, and the result is her first film, Little White Lie. Schwartz's interest in filmmaking began when she was studying law.
I went to Harvard Law School, and there's been so many kind of epic films made about the place, and yet my experience was so different. So we had to do a third-year thesis paper, and I decided I wanted to make a film about what I looked at as different experiences than what you might see at Harvard Law School. And so I got approval to do that, but I had no idea how to actually make a film, so the law school approved me to take an undergraduate film class in order to make this film. And I just loved the process. And I thought, wow, you know, I was looking at so many of my mentors who were successful entertainment lawyers, but I felt like they were frustrated creatives. And I thought, why am I going to spend all the time kind of building a legal career only to then have to build up a career maybe 10 years later as a filmmaker? I want to do this now. So when I graduated, I went straight into kind of development and production.
So tell me a little bit about the jobs that you had. So you wanted to be in entertainment. You wanted to be a creative. How did you get in?
Wow, you're bringing me back. Actually, at one point, I really thought very seriously about trying to become an agent. I was thinking about going into the mailroom. You know, I read the book, The Mailroom, and I thought, wow, I kind of loved it. You know, obviously, there's like a drive that the book deals with that I was relating to. I kind of had that go-getter thing, and I was in my mid-20s, and I thought, I really want to do this. But I also wanted to make films, and I was, you know, I did have that creative instinct. And so at a time, a friend had a production company, and I ended up working with him for his. He had a smaller documentary production company and had an amazing experience and then left to go and do TV. Worked with another friend who had a production company doing a lot of stuff for BET and did producing for that. And at that point, that was when this film I had really been thinking about and talking about and developing, and I was thinking, I'm never going to be able to keep on working on TV and also pushing this film ahead. Like, it's too hard. And so at that point, I went out on my own and I started doing all sorts of different consulting.
So you said you had this notion of doing a film. Was that this film that you started with?
It was a version of this film. The original idea was going to be much more focused on being Black and Jewish in a broader sense, not just as focused on my story. I started the film at a period of time when I was stuck in what I considered to be a racial closet. You know, I was kind of out and about identifying as being Black. And then in my world, I was looking at myself kind of the same way as I always had and was having a really hard time figuring out how to internally integrate my identities of being Black and Jewish. For me, being Jewish had always been synonymous with being white. And I was kind of befuddled by how you could be both things at one time. And so I became really, really fascinated with this idea of looking at how other people were managing to balance their identities of being both Black and Jewish. And I wanted to go on a journey, in a sense, to kind of talk to people and explore that. And I started doing that film. I went to Israel. I went to, you know, talk to different individuals, different celebrations, all kinds of stuff. And it was interesting, but I was really struggling to figure out what the story was and what it was really getting at. And so I knew that it was just something about it wasn't adding up for me. And I realized over a lot of pushing and working with some incredible advisors who helped me work through it, that I was never going to be able to integrate my own identities of being Black and Jewish until I dealt with my family secrets. You know, until I can have these conversations with my family, I truly cannot move forward with my life. And so I decided to really use the film as a way to model process of how to have difficult but what I consider to be important and worthwhile conversations.
How did you go about finding the financing for your film?
We funded it initially through grants, through different foundations and organizations, and then we did some individual donations. We did a Kickstarter campaign, and then that was kind of how we raised the first half of the money. And the second half of the money, we received funding from the Independent Television Service, ITVS. And that's
right,
when it became really a PBS-affiliated project.
So I'm wondering, you know, I read a quote that you said. You were talking about, you know, your dual identity, and you said there are benefits to being white. For me, it's walking into a space with a potential sense of entitlement, which I think is very important for anybody of any color. It's, you know, that if you carry yourself in a certain way, it almost becomes a self-fulfilling thing. And I wonder if you think that played a role at all in getting funding for this film or having the stamina to make the film.
Wow. I've never really thought about it. I mean, I think that I've definitely learned over the course of making this film that I am resilient. I don't think it was a word that I was in touch with before. I think most independent filmmakers who push their way through.
They have to be, right?
You know, they have to be, yeah. I mean, it's hard to answer because it's like, I mean, obviously there's so many Black filmmakers who have never experienced what it is to be white, and they have an incredible, you know, stamina, and they have an incredible ability to get projects done. You know, in terms of my ability to finish the film, it necessarily is the case. But I do think in terms of walking into a room and not having to question myself in quite the same way that maybe some other people will, because I was raised with that confidence and almost, you know, I say it in the film at one point, right? And like, I was raised to kind of believe I could do whatever I wanted to do and never have to think, well, do I have to overcome being Black in order for somebody to see that I am just as good as?
Right. So it's, I mean, it's obviously a question that requires more generalization than probably anybody
yeah.
would want to generalize, but it's still an interesting thing to say, well, you know, if you had been from a wealthy Black family and brought up in an environment of privilege, would you have the same confidence? Or is there something about whiteness in America that makes this, you know, when you're middle class or above, you have that sense of possibility? I mean, it's I don't know how you could ever entangle that knot. So I just wondered what your reaction was.
Everything is on a sliding scale, right? And everything is about that formula of how it all comes together within individuals. But certainly, you know, when you're looking at, if you take those scales separately, right, you look at issues of class, you look at issues of race, you look at all sorts of different privileges. I mean, I certainly think you can see it, but then it depends on, okay, if you put money with race, well, what does that look like? You know,
it's
hard to fully measure it.
It's impossible, probably. But let's talk about your parents. They play a huge role in the film, obviously, and you would have had to get them to cooperate. Your mom, you know, she seemed like she maybe started out reluctant and then got more warmed up. Your dad, it was really having, to the bitter end, I feel like, not an easy time with it, maybe somewhat for obvious reasons. But how did you manage to get to the point where they were willing to go on camera?
You know, in making a film like this, I went through my own struggle with, you know, asking myself, do I have the right to tell the story? Whose story is it to tell? And so I had to first have that conversation with myself to be able to own, okay, I'm doing this. I'm making a film about my story. You know, that was where I ended up, is really owning the fact that I'm telling my story and that my parents' story is, for better or worse, inextricably linked to my story. Like, it was literally the quandary I was in, is that I felt like I couldn't move forward in my life because people weren't talking about the issues around my paternity, which were connected to the secrets within my parents' relationship. And so once I got to that point of understanding that myself and being able to own that, it was much easier for me to go to other people and ask them, tell them what I was doing, and then ask them to participate in the process of making the film. You know, going back to privileges, one of the many privileges that I experience is I come from a very loving and supportive family, a family that's made a lot of mistakes, but nonetheless is really supportive, and nobody opted out, including my father, who, as you can see, you know, I think it's pretty fair to say, would have opted to take a different course. But once I decided to do it, and he knew I was going to do it with or without him, he did participate.
I wonder what would have happened had you done it without him. He's kind of a critical part of the film.
I mean, you know, I thought about this for a long time, not necessarily what I would have done without him in terms of the film, but like, I was very much at this place where I felt so strongly I needed to have the conversations openly with my whole family, including my dad, about the truth between my paternity and, you know, the racial issues connected to that. And what if he wouldn't do it? You know, what if he just said, I never want to speak to you again? Like, what would I do? How would I move forward with my life? I mean, forget this film, but how would I actually process that? And I realized, like, I just had to do it I had to push forward anyway. And the only thing I could do was do it in the most kind of up and up way, you know, and in the most respectful way, but also authentic way to myself and to other people that I could, and just hope for the best. And I really feel, I mean, honestly, quite validated for that, because if anything, I was so afraid going into it that we were not going to have a relationship coming out. The one of two things were going to happen. Either we were going to be exactly on the same page, which honestly didn't seem that likely, or we were going to have no relationship. And what I learned and how I grew was that it's not just as black and white, pun intended, as that. But it's, but it can, you know, there's actually nuances. There's other levels of in between. And once I spoke to him and said what I needed to say, I was in a sense asking him to accept me for who I was and how I wanted to deal with things. I then had to accept and deal with how he wanted to handle things, and kind of respect his boundaries as well, at the same time as I live my life.
Coming up after a short break, Lacey Schwartz shares how her relationship with her parents has changed since the release of her film, and talks about the danger that small documentaries like hers will be pushed out of primetime on PBS. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to first-time filmmaker Lacey Schwartz. Her very personal documentary, Little White Lie, aired on the PBS program Independent Lens, and half the funding for the film came from ITVS, the Independent Television Service. Documentaries like Schwartz's are in danger of being pushed out of primetime as big PBS stations chase higher ratings. In a recent New York Times op-ed, Norman Lear asked if PBS is neglecting its public mission by downgrading docs. He pointed out that these films provide a forum for minority filmmakers and feature diverse characters, attracting more Black viewers than other PBS programs. More on that in a bit, but first let's talk about the impact that Little White Lie had on Schwartz's family. The film started out playing at festivals where it attracted the attention of the New York Times. An article in that paper brought Schwartz's family a level of attention that they had not really anticipated during the years that she was working on her film.
I've thought about that a lot. I mean, I think when I was making it, I made it for so many years, right? I think my parents have always believed in me. And once it happened, they were like, okay. But I definitely think that there were times where they probably thought, oh, yeah, she's just, you know, making home videos.
Doing her little project. And I noticed, you know, when the New York Times asked for your dad and he didn't respond, I don't know whether that was because he didn't want to or he was like, I've done my bit and I'm not talking about this anymore.
You know, we haven't honestly talked about it extensively since it came out, and that goes back to me learning how to respect his boundaries. Although we don't talk about it a lot, we have had communication about it where he has let me know that he, you know, the way he is about things is he's just private about them and doesn't really want to talk about it anymore, but that he's proud of me and supports me in what I do. And that's huge for me. You know, that is a really a lot of growth for us. And so I think with the New York Times thing, we actually honestly didn't even talk about it. I just, you know, shot him an email, let him know that they were going to reach out to him and that he could feel free not to talk to them if he didn't want to.
Well, so your biological dad, you know, it's not like you met him and there was a thunderclap. You're very honest about how there was no instant bond between him or your half-siblings from his various relationships. He passes away in the course of, I'm not sure if you were filming, but or you must have been because you're shooting at the funeral, at the memorial service or what funeral for him.
Yeah, I had already started making the film at that point.
I mean, did you have to go to a bereaved family, which is your family, and say, would it be okay if I shoot for my film?
It wasn't really like that. I mean, when it came down to actually planning the funeral and being involved, you know, I did step up. And one of my sisters in particular, the one that's featured the most in the film, she was, besides me, the only person living in the New York area, which is where he lived as well. So when it came down to kind of planning the funeral and all of that, I wasn't necessarily doing it, but I was trying to support her. And she knew that I was making the film. And so as we were going through some of the planning process, I had asked her, you know, telling her I'd like to film this, and she was aware of that. So we did film throughout kind of the process of his funeral and the planning of the funeral and whatnot.
Nobody said, why are there cameras at this funeral? It's like very, you know, I sort of thought, wow, she got cameras into the funeral. It was just one camera.
I think there was two cameras, actually. We had to do two cameras. I mean, I don't know if no one said that. I'm sure people said that. They didn't necessarily say that to me. I did have a producer there. But, you know, one thing about that scene, although obviously a funeral is very intimate, it's also, there were hundreds of people there. And my biological father was quite a character and knew a lot of people. So in this weird way, the cameras were not as out of place there as they may have seemed, I think. I mean, other people may have experienced it differently than I did, but I think there was just so many people there and there was so much going on that the cameras weren't necessarily like as glaring as they might seem.
So the film had its, I guess, its official premiere last August at the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Jewish community is also very diverse, but do you find a sort of overall acceptance of the film, or does it depend on whether, I mean, have you mostly been in more liberal Jewish, environments as opposed to, God knows, you know, they can get pretty conservative too?
Yeah, it's been actually kind of amazing, like specifically within the Jewish film festival circuit. We've gotten an incredible amount of support. I thought, you know, this need to talk about things is generational, right? Like my generation talks about things and we overshare, and my parents' generation, they don't talk about things. My parents' generation older don't talk about things. And I'm finding, you know, I go to these Jewish film festivals all over the country and it's incredible, like these 90-year-old men coming up to me and saying, I connect to your story. I had family secrets. It affected me. You know, understand why it's so important to talk about them. So it's been pretty incredible, you know, people coming up to me for all sorts of different reasons, right? I mean, people with physical disabilities or sexuality or all sorts of different family secrets who really deeply connect to the story and to the process. And I haven't actually had that kind of response. And it's funny, like there are questions that I thought, you know, our whole festival screening approach with this was I wanted to do as many very diverse film festivals as possible, but I still thought that, you know, only the Jewish film festivals would like care about how I was going to raise my kids, you know, but it's so interesting how I get that question at Black film festivals too. There's actually more similarity in the Q&As and the questions I get than I thought there were going to be.
And I just wanted to ask you about this controversy I know you've been involved in. Last December, WNET, which is the main PBS TV station in New York City and the largest market, I guess, in the country, said it was going to pull Independent Lens from Monday nights and replace it with a repeat of PBS arts programming. And there was a terrific backlash from filmmakers, I think. They said they were going to hold off making a decision. I think that decision may or may not be near, but what do you think was the motive for that decision and what do you think is going to happen?
It's such a prominent PBS station, and I think the fear is who else will follow suit, right? If WNET doesn't do it, then other people will follow. And then, you know, these incredibly important series, Independent Lens and POV, will have to re-examine when they air and really put it at risk that other people won't see the projects. I mean, you look at the projects that have come out on those two series and you look at what the landscape is for documentary films. I mean, obviously, there's other players in the market. HBO does some incredible work and other places, but there's a lot of great documentaries going on PBS. And when if you don't support those kind of tentpole series, then what's going to happen to these projects, especially independent films?
I mean, I'll be honest. There's a thing in my mind about the whole David Koch controversy where he got very upset about, an Alex Gibney film that was about him, aired on that series. And there was a whole flap. I wonder, does anybody think they're trying to avoid controversy? I mean, what is to the degree that you feel comfortable telling us, what is the scuttlebutt in the filmmaker community about this?
I mean, I, like you, have also read those articles, and there was, I think in particular, The New Yorker did a pretty intensive piece on that, which, so I've followed it the same, but I don't have, you know, I don't have the inside scoop on it, but what I will say is I think it's a really tricky space for public media. There's kind of what is happening within public media. How do you get the attention for like the indies within public media? And then who's still supporting public media? Do we have the support of the government? You know, I know with public media being so scared of losing its support. So in certain ways, I'm kind of empathetic to both sides where you're trying to compete with other networks that are relying on advertising dollars versus public support, both from the government and from donations.
Or subscription dollars like cables, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the important thing, though, is I do think that so many viewers care about these programs. And so what's really important is for the viewers to speak up. So many filmmakers are organizing right now, and I've tried to do my part as well in terms of saying, this matters, this will affect the work we do. But we can't be the only voices out there. There also has to be the voices of viewers who stand up and say, one of the reasons that I donate to PBS is because I want to see these programs on the air in a prime time slot. And that is what I'm asking for as the consumer of your product.
Lacey Schwartz is the director of the documentary Little White Lie, which is available for purchase on iTunes, Amazon, and other platforms. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm a huge fan of the show, and it's really an honor.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Melissa Morton. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. And get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.